Now, that leads us then to antiangino drugs, right? Antiangino drugs are relevant to angina because of the pain that occurs when oxygen delivery to the heart cells is inadequate. And there are really three basic, or rather classical, I suppose, forms of angina. The most classic angina is sometimes called angina of effort or exercise-induced angina, and that's thought to be largely due to occlusion in the coronary vessels, atherosclerotic occlusion. In other words, the tubes are narrower, and therefore not as much blood is getting through, and not enough oxygen is being carried through to the cells. This is the most common form of angina, and you would test for that, of course, perhaps in some form of exercise test. Put somebody on a treadmill and see how far they can go before they can't go any further because of lack of oxygenation. Careful does it. Vasospastic or variant forms of angina are reversible. People sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and feel pain in their heart due to vasospasm in the coronary vessels. And that is a reversible decrease in coronary blood flow, vasospastic or variant angina. Unstable or crescendo angina is a sort of a combination of both classic and vasospastic angina coupled with platelet aggregation. Now, this is not something that goes untreated. This is what we would actually now reclassify as an acute coronary syndrome that is life-threatening. This is not the form of angina that you see people walking around with. This is the form of angina that is a hospitalized state and requires many drugs to manage. And we'll see that as a very separate item. For the moment, though, let us look at the most common types of angina, the classic angina and the vasospastic angina. The drug strategy here is fairly obvious: increase oxygen delivery or decrease oxygen requirement. And how could you increase oxygen delivery? Well, maybe you could cut down those vasospasms. And the two drug groups that are capable of doing that are the nitrate family and the calcium channel antagonists. The other way to go about it would be to decrease oxygen requirement. And that you can do by decreasing peripheral vascular resistance, decreasing cardiac output, or both of these effects. Nitrates will do that. Calcium channel antagonists will do that. And of course, you already remember that the beta blockers will decrease oxygen requirement. Now, so far, we have not really discussed nitric oxide in any real detail, but I thought it would be a good time now to talk about nitrates and nitric oxide pathway. Nitric oxide is made via the enzyme nitric oxide synthase from L-arginine. And nitric oxide, as I said, is a stimulant of guanyl cyclase. It actually promotes formation of the active form of guanyl cyclase, which takes guanosine triphosphate and makes it into cyclic GMP. And cyclic GMP is the responsible second messenger leading to relaxation in vascular smooth muscle. Now, you can make nitric oxide endogenously, receptors for acetylcholine on the endothelial cell, for bradykinin, for serotonin, for histamine for that matter, I forgot to put that one in, can activate these NO synthase, leading to increased production of nitric oxide. Now, you can also make nitric oxide from nitroglycerin and other nitrates. And by doing so, you're really bypassing the synthase, but you are not bypassing the guanyl cyclase. You're making the stuff and therefore still activating guanyl cyclase. So this figure just really simply describes for you that you can get nitric oxide either by, endogenously, and that will lead to vasodilation, or by providing it in the form of a drug that can actually break down to form nitric oxide. Either or will actually lead to the same event of vasodilation. So we can trigger nitric oxide formation by muscarinic receptor activation, bradykinin receptor activation, serotonin receptor activation, and histamine receptor activation. And as we said, we activate guanyl cyclase, we increase cyclic GMP. This brings about a dephosphorylation of myosin light chain phosphate, preventing its interaction with actin. Now, when we form nitric oxide from a nitrate, we dilate particularly large veins, decreasing preload and therefore decreasing cardiac work. And if you're not working so hard, you don't need as much oxygen. So that's certainly a very, you know, principal action of the nitrates in that regard. They are thought to do some other things as well. In addition to doing that, they increase blood flow through collaterals in the vasculature, into the heart, into the coronary vasculature. They'll decrease the vasospasm, and so this class of drugs can be used in vasospastic angina. And interestingly, there's a little bit of an effect to decrease platelet aggregation. It's not enough of effect that would be useful in the more severe acute coronary syndromes, but at least it's in the right direction. With high doses of the nitrates, you dilate the arterioles and therefore can decrease afterload. And once again, that will help out regarding cardiac work because you don't have to work so hard to get the effect. They decrease infarct size, postmyocardial, and also decrease mortality. Nitroglycerin would be one that I'd want you to identify. It comes in lots of shapes and colors, etc. Oral, sublingual, transdermal, IV formulations. Isozorbide dinitrate usually is the one that we think of as an oral agent for extended release. And what would you expect with the vasodilator? I'm hoping you will tell me flushing, headache, orthostatic hypertension or fainting, syncope. I'm hoping you will tell me reflex tachycardia and fluid retention, which obviously would be rather counterproductive. And it's for this reason that we sometimes actually use other drugs with nitrates. You see, a little bit of a calcium channel blocker might prevent the tachycardia, a little bit of verapamil, or a little bit of a beta blocker might do that. And so that's part of the rationale behind combinations. The adverse effects of nitrates, well, I'm not sure whether tachyphylaxis is an adverse effect, but it certainly is a limitation to their use. You should not use preparations that are present in the body for anything longer than about 10 hours. Anything that gets close to 12 hours or longer, you know, is not appropriate. You need a rest period, at least half the day, where the drug is not present to retain responsivity. So once again, tachyphylaxis is like a tolerance, but it can occur rather quickly. You'll see some evidence of methemoglobinemia occurring, but actually it's more likely with nitrites than it is with nitrates. Amyl nitrite is a good example of a drug that can cause methemoglobinemia, and that's not really used anymore, but it used to be used for an acute anginal attack. Watch out for other vasodilators. That's my message to you, all right? Because you're getting quite marked vasodilation with these drugs, and excessive vasodilation from other drugs can lead sometimes to such a reflex tachycardia that you may get an arrhythmia and sudden death. The drug sildenafil fits that category perfectly. Here's our Viagra. How does Viagra work? Well, it inhibits an enzyme called phosphodiesterase 5, PDE5, which is in blood vessels supplying the corpora cavernosum, and in fact, that's a rather selective, but not completely selective action. When you inhibit PDE5, you increase cyclic GMP, that leads to vasodilation, blood flow increases, and this increases erectile response. However, if used with nitrates or other potent vasodilators, you're going to get an excessive fall in blood pressure. So there have been very many warnings about the use of sildenafil in patients taking nitrates or other vasodilating drugs because of sudden death occurring, presumably through either an arrhythmia or a myocardial infarct. So I'm getting in two strikes here. I'm reminding you about the problem in a clinical sense, and since this is the only time I'm going to mention phosphodiesterase 5, now you know where phosphodiesterase 5 fits into pharmacology. It fits in with Viagra. Cyanide poisoning is not really a topic of, you know, managing angina, but you should at least know that cyanide poisoning is treated with nitrites. What happens is that you want to prevent the cyanide binding to the components of the electron transport chain. So what you do is you convert hemoglobin to methemoglobin purposely, because methemoglobin really loves the cyanide ion, and it grabs a hold of the cyanide ion to cause the formation of cyanomethemoglobin. So it's better to form that than it is to stop respiration in terms of complexing with compounds that are important for electron transport. You then convert the cyanomethemoglobin back to methemoglobin by using a thiosulfate, and this forms the less toxic ion, thiocyanate. And we mentioned thiocyanate as being a breakdown product, didn't we, earlier, of nitroprusside. It is less toxic than the cyanide ion. So I suppose the sildenafil and the cyanide poison could be looked at as really, you know, little sidebars in our mind, but they are relevant to nitrates. Here's the mechanism of smooth muscle contraction. What we see here is that we have an entry of calcium through an ion channel, which can be influenced by a variety of receptors. Calcium enters the cell, interacts with calmodulin, and the complex converts myosin light chain kinase in its inactivated form to the activated form. This then acts on the substrate myosin light chain to phosphorylate it, and it's the phosphorylated form of myosin light chain that can interact with actin to bring about a contraction. So I think you can fairly obviously see here that if in the production, for example, of guanyl cyclase activation, you are going to end up making more of the nitric oxide, as you do here, that this would in fact have an effect to cause dephosphorylation of myosin light chain phosphate, and if it's in the dephosphorylated form, it can't bind to the actin. You also see in this slide then the role of cyclic AMP in terms of beta 2 receptor activation causing phosphorylation of myosin light chain kinase. And in the slide you also see what would happen with a calcium channel antagonist. Since the whole business of contraction involves calcium entry to bind to calcium calmodulin, if you plug the ion channels that let calcium through by using a calcium channel antagonist, then how are you going to get a contractile event? You can't get it. So the diagram's good for several purposes here, and I think it would be a good review for you. As far as the CCAs are concerned, the CCAs, when used in the management of angina, are presumed to simply block, you know, the movement of calcium through these ion channels. And as I've just described, the words here are pretty much what I've said regarding how this influences the myosin-axin interaction. We can block the vascular L-type calcium channels, and that's important in terms of vasodilation. Arterioles are more sensitive. That will decrease afterload. That decreases cardiac output. You don't need as much oxygen if you're not doing as much work. All right? Those drugs then would also actually have the ability to decrease vasospasm. So we already talked about the calcium channel antagonists in terms of their side effects when we were dealing with hypertension. So I would suggest you refer back to that section if you want to remind yourself about the adverse effects here. Just for the record, let me tell you that nifedipine is vascular selective. Once again, it's a dihydropyridine. But verapamil and diltiazem are not so selective because they will block calcium channels in the heart and decrease cardiac output by that mechanism, again, decreasing the requirement for oxygen. One drug in this family, Bepridil, dilates coronary vessels. That's a very distinctive property. There aren't that many of them will do that. It's nominally classified as a calcium channel blocker, but notice it also blocks sodium and potassium channels. So it does more than simply block calcium channels in the smooth muscle. Lastly, then, in the area of the treatment of angina, we have beta blockers. Now, beta blockers don't do anything to the vasculature because I told you that, you know, if they did anything, they would probably oppose actions on beta receptors, but they really don't do that. So mostly we think they're working at the level of the heart to decrease cardiac output, decrease oxygen requirement by that mechanism. They're prophylactic rather than useful in an acute attack. They're not much good in vasospastic angina, for example. But they do offset reflex tachycardia caused by the nitrates. You see, you can't get a tachycardia in the presence of a beta blocker. One of the beta blockers, carvedilol, which is fairly recently introduced, happens to have fairly good activity as an antianginal agent by itself. It's been shown to be equivalent to isosorbide dinitrate, which would be one of the drugs for which we compare other agents in the management of exercise-induced angina. What about unstable angina, this life-threatening condition? The usual drugs that we've already talked about that we might use here are nitrates with beta blockers. Calcium channel antagonists have never been shown to improve outcome in these rather severe situations. You certainly are going to need oxygen, and that would be part of the pharmacological management. You also got the problem of clotting, of coagulation, platelet aggregation. And so we use anti-clotting drugs like heparin and warfarin, and anti-platelet drugs like aspirin and ticlopidine. The last step in platelet aggregation is a cross-linking reaction that involves a particular receptor called the glycoprotein 2B3A receptor. And in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen the introduction of 3 drugs that can inhibit that receptor. One of them is a monoclonal antibody called apixaban. One of them is a snake venom derivative called eptifibatide. These are drugs that have just come into use in the area of acute coronary syndromes, but they could be part of the management of unstable angina.